Good evening and welcome to Town Square. Tonight, a conversation with a man known as much for his profession of faith as for his willingness to provide health care services, including abortion, to women in locations where no such services are available. That would include parts of the Deep South, where reproductive rights advocate Dr. Willie Parker now lives. He recently spoke in Hawaii, once he taught at the John A. Burns School of Medicine. We sat down for an hour to speak about his assessment of progress, threats, and about Planned Parenthood. And a program note, this is a frank discussion, and as we're recorded tonight, the phone lines aren't available. We first talked about what's happening in the conversation over abortion on each side, with each convinced it's right, and little, if any, civil discourse between them. I asked him where that leaves him now.
I'm less interested in a more civil discourse than I am getting to the irreducible minimum of, given that we, in some ways, disagree, and that's intransigent in terms of neither of us is going to give because we both think we're right, what has to be the default? And in my mind, I'm not interested in a civil discourse if the grounds of engagement are women being devalued and their agency that they're entitled to as human beings is the bargaining chip. So I'm okay with people being vehemently opposed as long as our collective decision-making or the laws prevent folk from tyrannizing women around their human rights. What that's meant for me as a person of faith, understanding that when it comes to this whole argument in the context of religion, there are people who are people of faith who, because they think that they are right and they believe that they hold a moral absolute on this issue and that they are superior to me because my morals aren't theirs, those people have decided that it is mutually exclusive with me being an abortion provider and self-identifying as a Christian. And because they feel that they have a more legitimate claim to a Christian understanding and identity, they also are the self-appointed guardians of who's authentically Christian. And what that means is they've decided that they can excommunicate me from a faith identity when there's a conversation about faith and abortion. And so for them, I'm not their brother, and they're not my sister. And so for me, I tend, if I'm going to work that analogy a little bit farther, I tend to look at our disagreement about this issue as a sibling rivalry and an argument between siblings. So all human beings are my siblings. And even when we disagree, I will never disavow their humanity or disavow my relationship to them.
Even if they do yours.
Even if they do mine. That allows me to not be vested in cleverness of speech, articulation of the issue. I think the issue is weighty enough as it is. The morality and the integrity of what it means to protect the dignity of women is weighty enough. So it doesn't matter if I'm not as articulate as someone who's opposing me. The fact of the matter is, when we step out of the way of women exercising their agency to be the decision makers in their lives that they're allowed to be, and we stop allowing people to impose their particular religious understanding on what should be an evidence-based or scientifically-based decision, then I'm fine with the constant tension that exists, because Dr. King said that peace is not the absence of tension, it's the presence of justice. And so we will always be in tension as long as there is injustice, because I will always work to achieve justice, at least on this issue, because this is the work that I've chosen to do.
I hear you say that you're not going to compete, that that's not where your head's at, that for you the idea is to provide women services because they need those services, period. Is that accurate?
That's fairly accurate, because we may differ, and we hopefully, if we're both being thoughtful about it, we'll each evolve. And my idea behind engaging with someone who opposes abortion is not to create a vacuum for myself and to be alone with my own thoughts. I seek to listen clearly and compassionately to other folk who disagree with me. But while for us it may be an intellectual argument or an exercise in our own spiritual evolution, in the meantime, women still need access to abortion services.
And you see those women on a daily basis, and you know the facts and the circumstances of their lives very differently than a lot of other people do because you're their doctor. Is there something about what happens in that context that somehow isn't making its way into the general conversation that might change this conversation?
I don't think so. What it would require is for women to make their lives open to the scrutiny of people who should have no input into a very personal decision.
Some people would say, though, that if you look at the movement for marriage equality, if you look at the whole gay rights movement, that there were people who did, in fact, open the doors to their lives and did it knowing full well that there would be not only scrutiny but castigation. Yet that brought us to the point where we are now. Is there any pattern that you would see or any similar situation with women who have had abortions who other people might not realize that someone that they might value as a friend or colleague or a person of faith has also had an abortion?
Absolutely, with the personal choice of each individual to disclose that reality and with the personal choice of each provider to disclose that they provide this care, it certainly represents an opportunity to change the discourse. People feel comfortable vilifying others when they can otherwise, when they're convinced that nobody that they know would participate in the behavior that they find unacceptable. They are much more comfortable vilifying than they are when the father who's stridently anti-gay finds out that his son or daughter is gay. The person who moralizes about abortion and says that no woman in their family would ever have it. Some of those people have been the very people who have brought their daughters and sisters and mothers and wives to me to provide abortion care. So I think there is something to be gained if individuals consider it to the greater good to open their lives to the scrutiny so that they can say you can now no longer demonize people who make the sacred decision to have abortions because the person that you hold most dear and valued has also had an abortion, and I'm no different. So if you wouldn't vilify me as your daughter, you should think twice before you vilify someone who's not in your family. So I think there's something to be gained, but I think that has to be a personal decision to appropriate that kind of openness, just as I made the personal decision to not, in a clandestine manner, practice the abortion care that I provide. I'm a physician. I'm a healer. I'm a person of faith. I'm a person of conscience. The work that I do is honorable. I think it's always right to help people, and I find the service that I offer women when they are pregnant and they don't want to be, or they're pregnant and they can't be for health reasons or otherwise, that's honorable work. And so I open myself to the scrutiny of people who think that I'm not a compassionate, legitimate physician, and we'll just have to agree to differ on that fact.
Perhaps you more than some, because you go into a place where there would be no care except for what you could provide. You open yourself up to more than just scrutiny. You also know that potentially your life could be in danger, not like we haven't seen other abortion providers killed in the past. How do you go through your day with that specter, or do you simply just disregard it altogether?
I diffuse a little bit of it with humor. I say to myself and to some of my friends, life is fatal. Nobody's getting out alive. It's just to say that death is a part of life. We can either choose to avoid dying or we can spend our lives living. I take great inspiration and I patted myself after Dr. King when he says that everybody wants to live a long life, but if you haven't found something that you live for, that if your commitment to that issue could lead to your death, you're not fit to live. So that's not bravado in saying I'm not afraid to die. It is saying that the most meaningful living for me has meant having a purpose that is larger than me. And so the whole notion that I, because of my chosen craft as a women's health provider, found it in my own understanding of what my responsibility is to my fellow human being, that I found it important and essential to provide abortion care and that I've experienced the reward of helping women that nobody else will help, allows me to ignore the specter that there are people who are angry enough about this issue that they might try and harm me. So I spend my time living versus worrying about how I might die.
Good words for a lot of people. As you do fly in, though, let's say to Mississippi to provide care in a place where you're one of two providers to do that, what's your day like? This is still possibly a very dicey situation because that clinic has been attacked.
Yes. Well, as they say, I keep my eye on the prize. The same protesters who vilify me and call me names, I get to walk into the back door of the clinic. We have a perimeter, we have a fence, and the back door is farther away. The women who find the courage to come for the abortion care, knowing that they're going to be publicly shamed and vilified, that they have to walk down a street where two blocks away from the clinic, people spot them and bird dog them all the way to the clinic under the guise that they're offering street counseling, but they're actually harassing, cajoling, and demoralizing these women. My sense is that if women can muster the courage to pass through that, they can find the resourcefulness to come up with the money and the creativity to find childcare and a ride and all the other things that barriers that have been created for them, economic and otherwise. I decided that I simply want to make sure that there's someone there to provide care for them when they do that. I never want a woman to feel like when she's made the decision to exercise agency in her life that everyone is indifferent to her plight. When I focus on what it means to them and that they had to be courageous enough to come, it doesn't allow me to focus on the ways in which it is costing me personally to make the decision to provide this care.
You are more than just a doctor. You're also an advocate. And you have been very vocal and very visible in your advocacy for women's reproductive health, among other things. And certainly that includes abortion. How far are you willing to take your advocacy?
Well, I look at my advocacy in terms of I get to decide what is worth my time and what I will commit myself to. And then I have to let my life declare itself. I don't think anybody who ultimately ends up where it cost them their life to do what they do thinks that I'm willing to do this to the point of death. You declare that by your actions. You don't necessarily make that statement that I'm willing to die for this, although some people do. And I just don't think in terms of what's going to end my life. I am not reassured by the notion of if I don't do this work that I will live a long life. The only moment I have is the moment in front of me, and I get to choose how I spend that. I commit my life to what's worthwhile. And so the degree to which I'm willing to take my advocacy is I'm willing to use my influence in whatever sphere I have it to raise issues of fairness and justice, that I have a platform. I'm willing to use that platform to do just that. But I'd never assess my life in terms of how long I live, because Dr. King said very well, he said, you know, you can live to be 100 years, and if you have a death of spirit and you don't have anything that you're committed to, you're just as dead if you live 75 years beyond the moment where you thought it was more important to keep breathing than it was to be committed to an issue of what is right and what is just. So I've always been more afraid, at least in my adult years where I've thought about what the purpose of my life is, I've always been more afraid of a death of spirit than I have that my life is going to be over and I'm no longer going to be on the planet.
You've mentioned Dr. King. Clearly, he is a role model for you. But in the context of the time that he lived, he was also a flawed human being. We tend to deify people sometimes by taking them out of the context of their lives. We also tend to demonize them.
Sure.
I'm thinking about what a lot of people say about Margaret Sanger, that she was a racist, that she believed in eugenics, that this was a method of control. And yet you've been the recipient of the Margaret Sanger Award.
Sure.
You've been tied to Planned Parenthood in different points of your life. How is it that you make sense of Margaret Sanger?
Besides being the recipient of the award, which I was proud to receive, I also was humbled by the fact that being recipient of that award put me in lineage with some people who made me question my worthiness of the award, namely the first recipients during the same year were President Lyndon Baines Johnson and Dr. Martin Luther King. Based on why the award was given in terms of the commitment to the reproductive health and lives of women, as I've responded to the allegations of black genocide, that is a very clever but dastardly way of vilifying and shaming black women directly, but shaming all women about the fact that they have pregnancies that they choose not to continue. They've taken the history of Margaret Sanger and pulled her out of context. In the early 20s, when she was teaching birth control and contraceptive methods, not abortion, because abortion was dangerous, there was a high risk of death, she was not initially interested in the black community. She was going to the clinics in the various boroughs of New York where she had witnessed women dying from high parity and infection. The black leadership of her day invited her to provide the same information to black women because they knew they stood to benefit as well. So in order to legitimize her message, Margaret Sanger reached out to the medical community. At that time, what was considered legitimate science or eugenics was the thought about populations and population control. And so she initially had connections with them, but she ultimately disavowed any relationship to eugenics because they were about population control and who the right people were when she was about saving the lives of women. Because we are so uncomfortable and we don't have spaces to talk critically and meaningfully about race and the differences created by the social construct of race, it is very easy to spook, quote, white people when you raise allegations of race because the need to self-vindicate is so strong. Nobody desires to be considered racist. And so in order to make someone unsettled, all you have to do is say that was racist.
Reproductive advocate Dr. Willie Parker speaking about racism and reproductive justice. Tonight on Town Square, we're recorded to bring you this conversation. We continue now, and I asked Dr. Parker how the word racist often finds its way into conversations where it may not belong.
The fact that the disproportionate women who need abortion are women who are poor and women of color, two groups often synonymous but not always the same. The ability of people who oppose abortion to understand strategically that if they raise the specter of racism, that they can really create a chill effect for the providers who provide this care. The majority of providers are not black. And so when you raise issues of racism, the good-spirited white people who are healthcare providers who provide this care for women because they need it begin to self-examine and say, I'm not racist, or am I racist? So I think it's really easy to, if you don't know the full history, and if you have an agenda around indicting her for racism, to pull her out of the context. But I think it's unfair and it's really unethical to do so when it imperils women in this day, when no matter what Margaret Sanger's intentions were or what they weren't, it has nothing to do with a woman in 2015, no matter what color she is, making the decision to end a pregnancy that she doesn't want or one that she might want, but that might be lethal to her health.
Do you use that same argument for the way Planned Parenthood is regarded today?
I do. Planned Parenthood is an organization that has evolved to provide reproductive health and to embrace reproductive justice. And it does not have an agenda based on discrimination, but it has an agenda of providing health care for all. I understand, and it enrages me, when people misuse and abuse race. That's what I feel is happening when people make allegations of racism and genocide against Planned Parenthood or any other organization that is addressing the health disparities that exist because poor people and people of color have often worse health outcomes than others. So when they're engaged in the health care that people need, even if I can see their motives aren't the most altruistic, which I don't, I have a problem when people are willing to take away vital health care from people who already don't have enough health care. So you don't get much traction with me if you're going to make allegations of racism against Planned Parenthood when they are a vital portion of the health safety net, which means that many uninsured folk or people relying on Medicaid for their health care, the only option they have is that Planned Parenthood has a mission to provide primary care to the most needy people.
Meanwhile, there is a sufficient movement afoot that would like to see Planned Parenthood defunded, and defunded based on not only the issue of abortion, but the recently surfaced videos concerning fetal tissue. How do you begin to give some real facts or talk about the substantive issues of women getting health care when a lot of lawmakers in Washington are focused only on those videos, which are questionable, and the issue of abortion only?
Sure. Well, you know, it becomes clear that there's a difference between a politician and a statesman. Governor Johnny Burns, when he signed, as a devout Catholic, when he allowed the legalization of abortion in Hawaii in 1970 before most other states, was a statesman because he, independent of his personal beliefs, understood the importance of that vital health care to women. And so he did not violate his Catholicism by acting against his religious belief and vetoing. It would have been more Catholic of him to veto this bill. But he understood that he had to think about other people who weren't Catholic. So he allowed the bill to pass into law. The ideologically driven politicians who are beating the band to defund Planned Parenthood on the allegations made in heavily redacted, and pretty much it is just theater and drama. People have taken video footage, secretly obtained, finagled it so that it weaves a certain narrative to indict the integrity of Planned Parenthood, put it in the public domain, and politicians who've been waiting for an opportunity to consolidate their voting base based on social conservatism have led the charge to defund Planned Parenthood with understanding that there was some sale of fetal tissue that happened. In every case where Planned Parenthood affiliates have been looked at, there's been no evidence of any wrongdoing. Not one person has gone to jail. Not one facility has been closed. And yet politicians persist, even as independent verification of the video footage shows that it was heavily redacted. They've persisted in going forward with the idea of defunding Planned Parenthood. If you were in a court of law and your chief witness was discredited, nothing that person says would be counted. But in a court of public opinion, despite we have evidence to the fact that these videos were ideologically driven to indict the integrity of Planned Parenthood, we are marching forward the notion of defunding an organization that is a vital piece of the safety net. The reality is 3% of Planned Parenthood's mission is abortion. That means 95%+ of what they do is pap smears, breast screening, sexually transmitted infection, prenatal care. And despite that, the only funding that they participate in with regard to the government is Medicaid funding for primary care services. The Hyde Amendment is in place that prohibits the use of federal funding for abortion care. So the whole notion that Planned Parenthood uses fungibility to take the money that they would have had to expend on primary care services to provide abortion, if you defund them from federal funding, all that means is Medicaid funds go away. So that means women can't get their pap smears or their breast screenings. But the women who pay privately for abortions, as they've done since 1973, and that includes poor women who rely on Medicaid who have to pay out of pocket, those women, when they need abortion, they will still go to Planned Parenthood because Planned Parenthood will still be doing abortions. But what will happen is there will be more people who fall through the cracks for the essential health care services that they need. And so I would say that given that politicians insist on proceeding, they are abdicating their responsibility to do what's in the best interest of the people. By playing politics with people's lives, they're allowing politics to trump medicine.
Is the brouhaha over the videos just a smokescreen for defunding Planned Parenthood because of abortion, not because of fetal tissue use?
Absolutely. The shell company formed to create the facade of an investigative journalism group in order to do that, representing themselves to various Planned Parenthood facilities, as well as penetrating a confidential meeting, the National Abortion Federation, and filming people and jeopardizing the lives of providers because the doctors that were filmed in the video are undergoing tremendous harassment by people who believe that Planned Parenthood was selling body parts. The fact that despite what the evidence would show that they're moving forward means that this is it is mischief of the highest order, and the repercussions of it are huge. Again, what's going to happen is what they're hoping is that the facts won't matter. They're hoping that what they ultimately want to do is defund. They want to stop abortion. And with Planned Parenthood being the largest organization identified with abortion, they feel if you, quote, kill the head, the body will die. If you defund Planned Parenthood, if you discredit Planned Parenthood, if they now have to shut down, you know, they are the first domino to fall in the ultimate goal of outlawing abortion for everyone.
If in the scenario we're looking at now that perhaps Planned Parenthood would be defunded, what do you see happening coming in to either take its place in some way or be able to meet the needs of those women that you see?
Well, let me say Planned Parenthood is not going anywhere. It's an organization that has hundreds of clinics with a number of affiliates. And Planned Parenthood will still provide abortions. They still will take insurance and provide the kind of services that people's insurance will pay for. So Planned Parenthood won't go anywhere. But what they will, what will happen is their ability to expand their mission the way they would like will be greatly curtailed. And that mission, again, has been healthcare. They are not the only abortion providers. There's a large network of independent clinics and clinics that are affiliated with the National Abortion Federation, which does a lot of the quality assurance and the regulations of the quality of abortion care that's available.
But in terms of the actual day-to-day needs of women that might not be available if something were to happen to Planned Parenthood, because that seems to be real key to your argument in saying that this is the vast majority of the work that Planned Parenthood does. It's mm-hmm. not the abortion side. You're looking at, you know, what, you know, 95%, which is for other mm-hmm. reasons, for all the other things that you talked about, with the pap smears, with breast exams, with counseling for STDs, those kinds of things. That message doesn't seem to be as widely promulgated as the one that has Planned Parenthood attached to just abortion. Does that mean that there needs to be a different voice or another discussion about what Planned Parenthood really is all about?
I think there does need to be a broader recognition. And as they say, you know a person by who their friends are. Right now, people are so risk-averse and they're reeling from the apparent abhorrent behavior of Planned Parenthood, the perception that was created by the videos. And now slowly, as the pendulum settles and you see that you've had very unscrupulous behavior by people who are ideologically driven to destroy Planned Parenthood.
Or please their constituents.
Or to please their constituents. What needs to happen is the friends of Planned Parenthood need to speak up, or at least the advocates of women's reproductive rights and health. You don't even have to be a friend of Planned Parenthood. You can say, whatever Planned Parenthood is, I know the role that they play with regard to vital health services. And if you're going to defund them and destabilize them, just know that the women and the families who are reliant on Planned Parenthood will fall through the cracks, because Planned Parenthood is often operated in niches where nobody else will go. So when this issue was raised with politicians, they were saying, we do have the capacity to meet the primary health care needs that Planned Parenthood filled. But they're not being truly representative and genuine about that. So hopefully people will call them on that and produce the data and do the reports that show the role that Planned Parenthood plays in the communities where they exist. Or we'll find out experientially just what a vital role Planned Parenthood has played in primary care. And at that point, it'll be too late, because where will be the capacity to provide people with the services that they need if the organization that they've relied upon is no longer there?
Dr. Willie Parker speaking about Planned Parenthood. We talked recently when he was in Hawaii. Tonight on Town Square, we're broadcasting that conversation for you, and as such, the phone lines aren't available. Now we pick up our conversation about Medicaid and Dr. Parker's view of government's response to health care.
What I would like to see happen, which would be a constitutional amendment to see health care as a basic right. In lieu of that, we have to have people to really describe in very meaningful ways and to illuminate for decision makers the impact of these decisions, and not to allow them to be politicized. We can't allow people to take political stands and to grandstand because it plays good and it consolidates their base. I think, you know, we have to really illuminate the harms that are done when people don't have access to the services that they need. And I think it requires local responsibility at every level. There's a lot of devolution under the guise of states being empowered to provide for their own populations. So what that means is the Affordable Care Act creates responsibilities and creates funding at the federal level. But when you have people refusing, like in my home state of Alabama, where the governor refuses to participate in the Medicaid program and expand the Medicaid, right now there's a budget. There's no budget in the state of Alabama, and they've decided not to accept Medicaid funding, which is a two-thirds, one-third. So that means that they're going to forego $600 million in funding because they're refusing to appropriate the $300 million that they need to put up because they can't pass the budget. So what that means is clinics will close, especially in rural areas where people are reliant on publicly and federally funded clinics. And somebody needs to bring that to the attention. While we're playing political games, people's lives are at stake. So I think at the level where people know what the numbers are and what the realities are, they need to illuminate these so that people can put the pressure on their politicians to make the right decisions on their behalf.
That situation is not unlike what we've seen happen in Hawaii in rural communities for a great many things, for elder care, for children, for families, for women. But in taking that argument and saying they need to illuminate it, how do you see them illuminating that in a substantive way that might get people to understand it and understand the money that you and others say needs to go into providing that care?
We have to really engage politically. Yesterday, I lectured at the John A. Burns School of Medicine. And on my way into this beautiful facility down, all along the streets, there were homeless people camped out in tents. And I was made aware that there's a pending sweep to move the homeless people out of these areas and out of plain sight of the public's ability to see, you know, the stark reality. I saw families in tents. I saw women with children. I saw baby strollers parked by a tent. I saw people cooking food on the sidewalk. And the fact that that's the reality, who's going to speak for those people? Who's going to be the voice? How do those people empower themselves to speak on their own behalf? So I'm saying that at some point, from the ground up, people have to stop forfeiting their power and have to stop assuming that because they're not financially able to participate in political donations, that does not deny them their right to understand issues, to seek forums, to be heard on issues, and to exercise their right to vote. You know, I don't have all the answers about how to best go about doing that kind of agency and advocacy, but I do know that people need to decide that if you don't do anything, life will happen to you. That you can take control by via the venues that you have to raise your voice, that you can take control. You have to participate. And I know it's hard to participate when your most pressing thought is, how am I going to feed my babies? Or where are we going to sleep tonight? But while you make those kind of arrangements and decisions, you have to understand the implications of speaking up in the places where people decide where you're going to stay tonight and what you're going to be able to eat.
A lot of politicians will pay attention to issues like this when it is expedient for them to do that, when it's important for them to show that they are listening to constituents who say, what are you going to do about this issue of homelessness, or what are you going to do about fill in whatever that issue is? Your point is that it has to be a different set of drivers for those people who are involved. But sometimes that's very difficult when people don't speak English well, aren't aware that there can even be those opportunities, and when outreach workers are coming to them to be able to help them get those services so they know when they're going to eat and where they're going to sleep. Is there more that you see that needs to be done in the way those populations of people who are homeless or who are in deep need, who may be just working poor, are approached to understand that there is a place for them in politics if they choose to take it, or in civic life? Because that seems to have fallen away a whole lot in recent times.
Yes, I think there's all kinds of movement going on in various issues. Right? One of the more pressing movements on the mainland that I'm paying attention to right now is the whole Black Lives Matter movement, where people have simply become outraged that on average, almost every other day, a person of color, or that people are being killed on the street by police officers, oftentimes for nonviolent offenses. It's just a matter of, for whatever reason, that person is engaged with law enforcement, and it escalates to the point of lethality. And in particular, those victims have been Black men. And so people have decided that we can't wait for the politics of respectability to play out. We can't count on police commissions to hold police people accountable. We have to demand accountability from the streets. And so people have abandoned, per se, the politics of respectability or the traditional agencies expected to speak on their behalf. And they've taken to the streets. and they've made their demands, and they are engaging in civil unrest to say that it's not going to be business as usual. We are going to be heard, and we are going to seek legitimate venues to do that, and we're going to do whatever we need to do to be heard. So you can see people disrupting political campaigns where we saw Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Martin O'Malley held accountable and confronted about the issue. I think that's going to require people deciding that, as Fannie Lou Hamer said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that's going to have to prompt action. So I think if Dr. Martin Luther King and those guys had just decided that, well, it's the law. So when Miss Parks didn't get up on the bus, she had to expect that she would be arrested. But there's a point at which you have to say, whatever the consequences are, I simply refuse to be invisible and I refuse to be ignored. And I think in whatever, on whatever issue you're talking about, people are going to have to find the agency to stand up for what they know that they are entitled to as human beings and the basic level of human decency. What that means and the tactics of that are specific to each situation, but I think it's going to have to be ground up.
Having said that, what then do you make of what happened in Houston with the march where they were chanting, pigs in a blanket, fry 'em like bacon? That seems to be adding more fuel to the flame and not getting to the points that you're trying to make. Yeah. Is that a very unfortunate situation that has put Black Lives Matter into a very different light?
It is an eventuality of when people are frustrated and they have no venue and they have no recourse. Their movement rises up from various places, and no movement is ever monolithic. And during the civil rights movement, you had the NAACP was the larger issue, and then the SCLC came up, and the SCLC was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, headed by Dr. Martin Luther King, was by the NAACP's standard radical. And then the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee rises up in response to on-the-ground activism, because the SCLC was all ministers and through church and was talking about Christian values, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee were radicalized with regard radical towards human rights and civil rights college students who felt like we were being too passive. So what I'm saying is, as you see, even in the civil rights movement, now we look at what we thought was the inevitability of that movement, but it was a very heterogeneous movement. So when you fast forward to today, you have people in the Black Lives Matter movement who are trying to appeal through legitimate means to people who are participating in the political process and being thwarted, disparaged, even by people who fancy themselves as progressive. They're being told to shut up and to step aside and to let Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or anybody else that we perceive as progressive do the class battle, and that class battle will give away to racial justice. They're saying, no, you know, we want accountability. We've been pacified for too long. And there are people who say, screw the Black Lives Matter movement. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. We're now seeing the evidence of what Dr. King knew and what the Mahatma Gandhi knew. And that is that the end has to be preexistent in the means. There's no right way to do the wrong thing. You can't fight violence with violence. And the Mahatma Gandhi said that even if there appears to be short-term gain from a violence-based strategy, the ultimate long-term gain is there's always going to be more damage done with violence than there ever was any short-term benefit. And that is why you can never use as a tactic violence, because violence only begets violence. So it's convenient for folk who don't want to deal with the Black Lives Matter people at all to amplify, you know, the kind of disgruntled, frustrated group of folk who are now advocating openly violence against police. But that is occurring at all. It's only an outcome of what happens when people have no legitimate process for grievance.
And what about the other end of being able to extend into the community to have some more of those conversations about grievances? And does that same kind of logical argument in your mind also play into the issue of reproductive justice, where for women for an even longer time, not being able to have some of the services that you provide and have to feel that maybe they would be in jeopardy at some point? Do they, if they're not going to obviously be violent about that, what then do they need to do in both of those situations, both with the Black Lives Matter and also with women dealing with reproductive justice? What do you see they need to do to be able to further the national understanding?
The most important thing is, just as with the LGBTQ movement, people have to decide that they're not going to be invisible. They have to decide that they're not going to indulge power structures to be beyond accountability. They're going to have to decide that they're not going to allow the perception to persist that go along to get along, life is fine as it is. It may not be what I want. It can always be worse. What that would mean to me from a reproductive rights and reproductive justice standpoint is, first, women have to find the space and the understanding that their lives aren't open to the caprice and whim of powerful men or powerful people. And so they have to understand that abortion is health care, and it is their right, their essential right, to decide when and whether or not to become a mother. It's their entitlement to medically accurate sex education and scientific and evidence-based forms of contraception. And when they come to recognize that they're not asking favors of society for things that are inherently theirs, then they have to step up. And so then once they step up and say, we're not going to be tyrannized anymore, then movement can take place and figure out and strategize about what is the best direction to go. I think Howard Zinn said, the cry of the poor is not always just, but if you don't listen to it, you won't know what justice is. But in order for people to listen to you, you first have to raise your voice.
That's reproductive advocate Dr. Willie Parker about his vision for women in taking back their voices and power. We talked during his recent visit to Hawaii, so tonight on Town Square, we're recorded and the phone lines aren't available. We continue now as I ask him how he sees his role in how women claim their voices and power.
Women have to, well, first of all, far be it from me as a man to sit here and tell women what they ought to do or what they have to do. But as someone who's fighting for the rights of women in the context of human rights, I see that the most important thing for women to do is to assert the dignity and the rights that they are due, and then they figure out the most strategic way to do that. But first, they have to feel the entitlement around basic health care and reproductive rights.
Has feminism fallen flat?
A question appropriately asked is 50% answered. I think talking about feminism in the singular defies the notion that feminism has various waves of iteration where additional filters of accountability have been added. Probably in the more recent iterations of feminism, having to deal with issues of LGBTQ as well as issues of race when it comes to reproductive justice, the ways in which the lives of Black women and non-Black women aren't necessarily homogenous enough for there to be a single agenda. I think when we talk about feminism, feminism hasn't fallen flat. Feminism, as it evolves, has not reached its full potential. I think feminism has a broader frame of reference to speak now more to the lives of women other than in its earliest waves, where it was middle-class white women, and they alleged that they were speaking for women and on behalf of all women when, in actuality, they hadn't spoken to all women. There was no representation of immigrant women in the earlier waves of feminism. There was no critical dialogue between Black women and white women on what constitutes empowerment in the earlier waves of feminism. Now, all of these lived experiences are coming to bear on feminism, and it's a pressure for feminism to evolve, to speak to a broader frame of reference. So I would say, to the question of whether or not feminism has fallen flat, I would say feminism has growing pains and is evolving. It still has the capacity to be a tremendous tool for change, but it still has to some growing and some internal work to do.
Is that growth something that you see happening in the sphere of women's reproductive rights and the issue of abortion?
I do see feminism evolving to have a voice that is more informed by the lived experience of different women. I think, again, the monolithic nature of what feminism was to represent is now changing as it's being informed by the lived experiences of non-white women who are speaking up about what their lives are and what their lives matter. And they're saying, you know, we're at the table too. So, for example, something as simple as if the empowerment for white women initially, because they were confined to the home space and confined to being mothers and wives, and they desire to get out into the common space to actualize if they wanted to be an engineer or whatever else, they were fighting to get out of the home. But the lives of black women who were maids and domestics and who were always required to take care of other people's children and to breastfeed other people's children, for them, empowerment meant they wanted the right to get home to be able to raise their own kids. So it seems like a mutually exclusive interest. So feminism had to morph so that it could speak to the life aspirations of women coming from different points of view. So I would say that feminism is morphing to the point where it can be a powerful tool. And in the issue of abortion, those same sensibilities are coming to bear, you know, that black women and Latino women have the highest rates of abortion for multiple reasons. The reality is white women have the absolute highest number. So when we talk about what are the realities of race and class as it pertains to abortion, what does it mean to provide access? You know, does access mean we create the ability for women to choose between a medication abortion and a surgical abortion? Does it mean where the clinic is located? What does access mean? And that decision about access to abortion is now having to be informed by the heterogeneity of the lives of women in this country when they're all trying to get access to the same sort of empowerment.
From what you've just said, it seems as if the nexus for all those varieties of women seems to be the abortion issue.
Well, it's funny that you should say that. When I was the medical director of Planned Parenthood in Washington, D.C., I provided abortion care for staffers on the Hill, lawyers, doctors, but also for young women who had teen pregnancies over in Southeast D.C. And they all had a broad class, race, and ethnicity structure, but what they all had in common was the fact that they were all at risk for an unplanned, unwanted pregnancy if they were heterosexually, sexually active. And when it came to abortion access and care, they all were in the same position in terms of accessing services. By that I mean it wasn't that, you know, wealthy people can get things even when they're illegal for somebody else. But it was that if there are no providers, it doesn't matter how much money you have. Poor women and wealthy women are in the same place. So abortion is a common lived experience for women and can be a point of solidarity around which they can come together and say, we have a common vested interest. But abortion, we're still fighting to just have abortion recognized as a life event for women, one of three who women in this country age before the age 45 will have. And so something so uniform should build solidarity around the effort to secure its availability.
Going forward, as you look out over the coming election, what may happen afterward, just in general, the spirit of what you see as you travel throughout America, how do you characterize Americans now in terms of understanding what reproductive health looks like, understanding the needs that women and men have, and also the responsibilities they have to each other?
Well, I think our country is so affluent, and so there are so many opportunities on so many different levels that there are so many things that people take for granted, and that we've had 42 years of Roe being in place and abortion being legal, and that contraception, because it's in the marketplace, there are multiple iterations and innovations in that regard. It creates the perception that almost anybody can get contraception if they wanted it. The fact that abortion remains legal in all 50 states, it creates the perception that it's been legal for the last 42 years and it will always be legal. I think even though as people get their way around outlawing things related to reproduction, like restricting access to contraception, outlawing abortion, there's still the presumption that those things will always be around and always be available. So I think we still operate in with the veil.
Are we too complacent?
I think we're complacent because we think that the things that have always been available in our lifetime will always be available. There are people who are less than the age of 42 who've never known a world without abortion access. I'm 52 years old. In 1973, I was 11. I've lived in a world where there was no abortion, but I didn't know what that world looked like. And now I practice medicine for the last 25 years, and I see firsthand what the plight of women has been as things are restricted. But I think people are still living in with the facade that abortion will always be legal and it'll always be available. And I think it is under that facade that ideologically driven people are consistently and rapidly eroding this thing that we take for granted.
And using those terms, we and our, obviously you're speaking for a very distinct sector of America. There are those on the flip side who would be delighted if it went away tomorrow.
They would be delighted because they live in a world where there are two sets of rules. There are the rules that they live by, and there are the rules that everybody else lives by. And the rules that they live by are largely predicated upon their economic security and their financial wherewithal. You know, I had an ex-girlfriend who once said to me that if you have a problem and it can be solved with money, it is not a problem. And I think that the people who would be delighted that abortion goes away or reproductive health, they're the people who are ruggedly individualistic in their thinking. They think that they're self-made people. And they think that there's nothing that they can't have because their money entitles them to it.
Or their religious belief says that they should be above this kind of scrutiny that happens at a government level.
Absolutely. So the people who fancy that they're going to outlaw abortion, and when you outlaw abortion, abortion will stop, are people who don't understand that, like anything that you make illegal, all you do is create a black market for it. Right. People, there's one of my colleagues, or at least one of my mentors, Dr. John Shara at Northwestern University, says that there's not been the law passed yet or the insurance coverage denied yet that when a woman is resolute about ending a pregnancy, that she won't make every effort to make that happen. So what will be different is the desperate measures to which women will be driven to accomplish this goal that they will pursue when they don't want to be pregnant, which is what they did pre-1973 and what they'll continue to do. And the major difference between when abortions are legal or illegal is not necessarily the number of abortions that occur, is the morbidity and mortality associated with abortion becomes dangerous when it's illegal. So there are people, again, this fantasy that if abortion is illegal, that it will stop. Really translates into, I don't care what happens to folk if they make the decision to have an abortion because it's illegal, but I know that if somebody in my family needs an abortion, if it's not legal here, I will fly her to the place where it can be done safely. In the same way that pre-Roe, white women were, because they had insurance coverage, abortions were done in hospitals. Women could present themselves to their doctor who would tell them how to navigate the ethics committees to legitimize their access to safe abortion in the hospital. Women of color did not have that same access. So because of that, disproportionately, where we took numbers of who died from unsafe abortion, overwhelmingly, they were women of color and they were poor. one series in New York showed that of the women who died in 1971 or 72 in New York from illegal abortion, over 75% of them were black and brown. So, again, yes, there are some people who would celebrate if abortion became illegal because they use the status of legality to impose the tyranny that they wish to see.
Having said everything that we've talked about over the last hour, how optimistic are you about the state of women's reproductive health in America?
I remain optimistic because every day that I get up is an opportunity for us to change the world. And I see women exercising their agency and stepping into their power. Growing up in the South, the older people, when they would see a civil rights setback, I remember hearing the older people say, in times like these, it's always been times like these. So that the war and the battle, if you will, around reproductive rights is heating up. There's never going to be a day when women don't have to fight, or anyone who's in a system where there's the potential for them to be oppressed, there's never going to be a day that you don't have to fight for that. So I feel that, as Dr. King said, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And that includes reproductive justice. We're on our way to women having access to the resources and the care that they need to control their reproductive lives. And so it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Dr. Willie Parker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's reproductive advocate Dr. Willie Parker, once a professor at the John A. Burns School of Medicine. We sat down during his recent trip to Hawaii, and tonight we brought you that conversation. If you missed any of the show or want to hear some of it again, it'll be on the HPR2 archive. Just look under Talk Shows and then Town Square. I'm away for the next few weeks. Neil Milner will be sitting in, and coming up next week, looking at domestic violence through a man's perspective. The panel will take a look at the Men's March. Plan to join him next week right here on Town Square. The phones will be open. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I will see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for joining me tonight. Aloha.